Hi, everyone. I'm attorney Donna DiMaggio Berger, and this is Take It to the Board, where we speak condo and HOA. My guest today is Vice Mayor Saray Martin. Vice Mayor Martin was elected to serve the approximately 71,000 citizens of Lauderhill, Florida in 2020, and his term runs through November 2024. The city of Lauderhill was established on June 20th, 1959. The founding father was developer Herbert Sadkin, who had originally planned to name Lauderhill Sunnydale, but later changed his mind. Lauderhill was originally known as Dairy Farm Country because there were far more cows than people within the borders of the city. Vice Mayor Martin, or Ray, is the past chairman of the Lauderhill Community Budget and Advisory Board. He is past vice chairman of the Lauderhill Housing Authority and is president of the Kiwanis Club's Central Broward chapter. He's originally from New Brunswick, New Jersey, and he is a veteran who has served for 22 years in the U.S. Army. He retired in 2015, and he owns a company called Extreme Government Solutions. I'm delighted to have Vice Mayor Martin here today. He's had me out to Lauderhill several times to talk to residents of his city about changes in the community association legislation in Florida. So Vice Mayor Martin, welcome to Take It to the Board.
Hey, thank you. Happy to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Well, I wanted to ask you, because I ask all the people who are elected officials when they come on the show, what got you interested in public service?
After retiring from the Army, I've been a public servant all my life. My family, I come from line of public servants. My father is a retired Broward Sheriff's Office. My sister currently is working with the Broward Sheriff's Office. And when I retired from the Army, I came back. I observed some of the things that were going on in the city that I felt could use some change. And instead of being the person who points the finger, I decided to raise my hand and decided to serve my community.
Well, that's great. Did you grow up in Lauderhill?
I moved to Lauderhill, relocated from New Brunswick, New Jersey, when I was 12 years old, 1988. And then I finished my time here, went to school here, went to Boyd Anderson High School, later graduated from Hollandale High School out of the magnet program. And then I joined the Army at 17.
You joined the Army at 17. Was it everything you thought it would be?
Initially, no, but I ended up making a lifetime career out of it. So it turned out to be well for me. Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say 22 years. So I mentioned at the outset, Lauderhill has approximately 71,000 residents. You've got a median household income of $38,805. Many of your citizens live in older condominium buildings that are impacted by the new safety laws in Florida that we've been talking about on this show. You know, in the aftermath of the Surfside tragedy, the Florida legislature, they passed some very robust legislation 2 years ago in special session. It was SB 4D. They just passed a glitch bill, Senate Bill 154, which is trying to clean up some of the questions that the condo safety law created. But of course, now this has created even more questions. But are you hearing from the people in Lauderhill who live in these older condominium buildings about what kind of impact these laws are having on them, particularly having on their budget?
Yes, absolutely. Having so much an impact that I ended up initiating and creating a Lauderhill Condo Association Forum, where we invite homeowners and condo owners out to discuss some of those various issues. More specifically to your question about the increases in their dues and maintenance fees and the reserves and the impact it's having on our residents. Many of our senior citizens have paid off their condominiums. They're on a fixed income. They're on a fixed budget. And these fees are almost double to try to catch up their reserves, as well as increase their maintenance to try to meet the new, or maybe not new, or just the more stringent standards for the inspections. And they just simply can't afford it. And some of them are at risk of losing their condos that they paid off and worked their whole life for.
And we can't forget the property insurance crisis here in Florida. I know the legislature's been, you know, trying to pass some new laws regarding the insurance industry, but we haven't seen anything beneficial come out just yet in terms of lowering the premiums. So a lot of your folks are also, in addition to the budget increasing because of everything you just said, the, you know, catching up on reserves, undertaking much needed repair projects. Now they've also got the insurance premiums, which increase in many cases 50, 60, 70% or more.
You're absolutely right. You hit a hot topic. And so recently when we had this storm here, just a few years back, some folks don't have insurance and these roofs are not covered. And then with the increase, they're also denying coverage as time goes on and the availability of insurers are getting smaller and smaller.
So what can be done? I mean, I get the phone calls too all the time, right? And it's boards. So we represent associations and it's the board saying, we have to pass a budget to pay for these things. We have to get insurance. We have to meet these deadlines for engineering inspections. You know, our community has waived reserves for four decades, and now we're telling them you can't. But of course, all of that means that their assessments are going to double or triple. And what do you say when people are coming up to the board members and saying, I can't afford this? Does it just mean that these people have to sell their units and move somewhere else? Is that the only solution we're offering?
As of right now, I think you hit the nail on the head. I'm really at a crossroad where we don't know which way to go. We don't know how to solve this problem. I started researching and I can't remember which organization put out a podcast or interview. We may need to start looking at the deconversion. I think that may end up becoming the solution in the future, because other than that, without any government bailouts, I don't know what the fix is. Because right now, when I'm talking to some of the residents, some residents are already behind on their association and their dues. And so as the dues and fees increase, the residents that can pay or struggling to pay have a hard time deciding if they want to pay. They're wondering if they're putting good money behind bad money and if they should save that money and sell their condo and go try to find somewhere else. But as you know, all the prices are high. So no matter where they go right now, they can't afford any new purchases.
It is a conundrum. I don't know that the legislature has fully thought through what is going to happen in the future with all of these association residents. Does Lauderhill have any funds that you can earmark for potential loans or grants for some of these condo residents to catch up?
Currently, we do not. We are trying to be creative. We have our grants department researching grants. So let's say, for example, if there's grants out there for environmental concerns that can address stormwater, maybe we can tie in some repairs to some of these communities into that and partially find a way to find some funding. We are trying to find some creative ways to finance some of these projects. But as of right now, we don't have that. We don't know if we will even get it. And then there also comes the challenge between the condo associations being considered a private community and not under the purview of the city. So they're kind of like on their own, but we are trying to take the initiative to see what we can do to help some of these boards and help some of these condo communities to address their concerns.
Well, you touched on something that I want to talk about, which is, you know, when you're living within the borders of a city, you're paying taxes and the city's hopefully providing you with police and EMT and waste management and all the other services that come along with operating a municipality. But for people living inside a mandatory homeowners association or a condominium association, they're a mini government unto themselves. And they are paying assessments to that homeowners association or condominium association to take care of certain things, the roof, the exterior building, paving of their parking lot. What do you say to people who say, you know what, we're paying taxes to the city, but we're also paying assessments to our association?
Right. We are experiencing some of those same challenges within our mandatory HOA communities. They'll complain to the city about overflooding due to stormwater and their stormwater drains not being cleared or their streets not being repainted. There's quite a few things that either their association can't pay for or they didn't budget for, where they're looking for some city help. But then, like you mentioned, that there's this barrier or legal entity that they're on their own that prevents the city from coming in. So one thing we're currently trying to do with one community, we're trying to come up with an agreement where they'll allow us to come in and support them in certain ways that they cannot. But we also have to find ways in our budget to be able to afford those services, because we didn't budget in additional drains to take care of. We didn't budget all those into our costs. because we wrote our budget believing that they would sustain themselves. And now that that is not happening or they're having challenges, we're now trying to relook how can we partner together. We don't want to just leave them out there on a limb. We do want to find some way that we can provide some mutual support.
Do you know, Vice Mayor Martin, how many associations are inside your borders, you know, relatively speaking?
Inside our Inverary community, we have 31 mandatory associations. And just outside of our Inverary community, we have two subdivisions that are mandatory. I believe the Cypress Hollow and Forest Lake Estates.
So the Community Association Institute, or CAI, they routinely survey people. And they put out annual surveys, special surveys. One of the things they ask people is, why do you buy in a mandatory association in the first place? And one of the things they'll say is, oh, well, we buy in there because we want quicker response time on things like, you know, I move in, my neighbor has his or her car up on, you know, cement cinder blocks, or they painted the house next door purple. And I think the perception is that when you're living in a mandatory association, that that volunteer board is going to act more swiftly to resolve these kind of disputes as opposed to going to code enforcement. Is that an accurate perception that they can get to it quicker?
Yes, that is the accurate perception. And even some, and one of the things that our Inverary community is currently dealing with is we have a golf course that's no longer functioning. And so we hear a lot of arguments saying, hey, I bought my condo to be next to our golf course, but the golf course is no longer there and it looks all rubbish and it's terrible. And they're looking for some help. Again, the golf course is also private property. But what I have seen now happening over the past few years is the management of these boards are left sometimes to volunteers. Sometimes those volunteers may not be necessarily trained. Sometimes those volunteers have nefarious ideas and activity that takes money out of their budget. Sometimes they hire property managers that may do a good job or a bad job. And so as time goes on and the budget gets depleted, and then you add on these requirements that's requiring them to fund the reserves, it's kind of like a perfect storm. So all the things that they want to get done with immediate response, is the capability is no longer there for some communities. Not all communities are suffering, but there are some. And then you couple that with investors taking over, bypassing the bylaws and putting tenants in, and then the investors no longer have a vested interest. Some investors, I'm not going to say all, some investors, and all they want to do is collect their fees from the tenants, and the tenants don't have the buy-in because they don't plan to live there forever. And so it becomes a challenge.
I'm sure you've heard of the case in Miami-Dade Hammocks, the Hammocks community with the fraud and the arrests. And I think there was upwards of $1 million that went missing. And that actually generated a bill that passed this last session, I believe it's House Bill 919 by Representative Porras, to address that kind of fraud in a community association. Listen, it's going to boil down to when this kind of fraud is discovered, that people are subject to law enforcement, that they're going to be criminally tried, and they're going to serve a sentence for whatever criminal activity they've engaged in. Is Lauderhill prepared to, and I don't know if you've ever had these cases come before you, but is Lauderhill prepared if and when you have that kind of fraudulent activity or corruption going on inside your borders in a mandatory association to take action?
We are prepared, and we have dealt with this. A similar case is over $1 million. The gentleman was arrested. We did, you know, file a case against him, and it was founded, and he was found guilty. The challenge, and that's kind of another one of the reasons that I ran, is that I make it a personal issue to try to solve some of these problems. Because prior to me running, the word that I heard that when the condo community and these boards raised the complaint to the city's response was, talk to your ombudsman. You're governed by the state of Florida and city has nothing to do with it. And so once I realized that they're kind of being left out there in the cold and they really don't know who to turn to, I initiated the condo forum so that we can start uncovering some of these issues. There are some residents that are intimidated by their boards. They're afraid to come forward. So I asked them to bring their issues to me. so that we can start our own internal investigation where we work with our chief of police, and we'll send in undercover to do an investigation and see if we can rot out some of this crime and bad actors.
I think that's great. And at the end of this episode, I'm going to want you to give me some resources so people know where to find you. Broward County has 31 cities. Does Lauderhill work with the League of Cities on these sort of issues, including on affordable housing? I've had a number of guests come on the podcast and talking about what a crisis the lack of affordable housing is becoming in Florida.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. And we are a member of the Florida League of Cities as well as the National League of Cities. I serve on there. I attend the city meetings. We also have Broward League of Cities where we get to share information from other cities and compare and contrast our notes and best practices. And affordable housing is a problem all over. For the city of Lauderhill, we have very limited land space. Most of our space is already developed. So when we get new developers coming in, we ask that they, part of their development agreement with the city, is that they allow some of the units, make them affordable. And we're getting away from where I say there's the terminology of affordable housing. What some may call affordable may not be affordable. So I think the new term is current rates, or there's a new terminology, but affordable may not always be affordable for many people.
Sure. It's all relative. I agree. But you mentioned a few minutes ago about the two Inverary golf courses. You got a couple hundred acres there. It's privately owned. Are there any plans in the works right now to develop that acreage?
Yeah. So currently it's about 300 acres. It's owned by a private individual. And within the Inverary community, when they purchase their homes, there's what they call a covenant. This covenant is to prevent the development of the golf course. This covenant, in order for it to be changed, it would require 2/3 vote of members in order to change the golf course's covenant. And as right now, there is currently a contractor or a developer who has an option to buy the golf course with the intent of hoping to come to some agreement with the Inverary community in which they will be willing to forego the covenant in exchange for a newer golf course, provided some residential housing so that they can recoup some of their funding. Currently, some of the residents do not have an appetite to allow for any housing. And so therefore, the developer is not moving ahead, but they still have the contract, but they're not maintaining it as a golf course. So it just kind of turned into vacant land that's now harboring wildlife that includes, you know, foxes and everything else out there. So the residents do not want the vacant land, but they're also currently not willing to remove the covenant and allow for more development because it's just going to make the area more congested, more people. And that's not why they bought. They bought there because they wanted to be on a golf course, not to look at a new apartment building.
Sure. No, that's understandable. The two pretty famous golf courses designed by Robert Trent Jones in 1970, right? Yes. You want to talk about the famous guy who kind of put Inverary on the map with those golf courses?
Yes, I grew up watching the Honeymooners, and come to find out that it was Mr. Jackie Gleason. I think his home was just recently up for sale here in Lauderhill. Jackie Gleason, I believe, brought the Honda Classic, which was the beginning in 1972, and they had the classics from 1972 to like 1980. And so we had a very vibrant community. The Inverary community was doing well. Lauderhill was on the map. We had a lot of famous golf players that come through our golf courses. And it really hurts some people that we can't get back to those days.
Two things. One, I represent the community in Lauderhill where his home was located. So I recently got a tour on a golf cart and saw his home in there. It's very large. Okay. The other homes are very nice, but his just really stands out. And I don't know if I ever told you this, but I was married at the Inverary Country Club.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. I was. My dad was a huge golfer. He was a member of a number of different country clubs. But at the time that I got married, which was, oh God, how long was that? 1990. It was at the Inverary Country Club. Wow. Yeah. And that's where they had the peacocks running around on the grounds. It was beautiful. Yes. So I hope something really nice goes in there.
Okay, great. So I'll let the residents know to call on you because you have historical, you have a historical moment there that you want to save.
I do. Actually, I do. It would mean something. I remember the waterfall and it was just, it was lovely. It was really lovely. So great. I wanted to talk to you about your educational programs. And I happen to be familiar with them because you've had me to your community leaders breakfast. But I'd like you to talk to our listeners a little bit because I think your city in particular has done a great job educating your citizens when the new laws come out that impact them. And before you, I dealt with Commissioner Margaret Bates. She was fantastic. And then you came on board. Tell me a little bit about what kind of emphasis you put on education.
So what we do is we have lobbyist firm, Becker and Polakoff, where we have our legislative assistants and liaison. We work with Ms. Jackson, Yolanda Jackson and her team, where they go get their information from Tallahassee. They'll bundle it up, send it back to us, let us know what we need to keep our eye on. And so what our city manager does, our city manager stays engaged with our state reps, as well as myself and the commissioners. We stay engaged with our state reps, and I believe that's Representative Lisa Dunkley and Representative Daryl Campbell. And so when the time and the opportunity is there, we'll set up the appointments. That's what Yolanda Cash Jackson will do. When legislation is in session, we'll take a trip up there. They have this time sometimes called Broward Days. Well, it'll give us an opportunity to go around and meet with all the bill writers and co-authors, where we can advocate and fight for our city and bring back any changes that we see coming. And then when we come back to our city, what we do with our city is, as you had mentioned, I have a community leaders breakfast that I carried over from Commissioner Bates, where we invite attorneys such as yourself or those that's smart in the reserves process or property management. We also do a condo association forum where we also invite guest speakers so that we can inform board members of the educational programs that are available to board members that they should partake in before taking a seat on the board. We educate them with property managers, what they should look for in a property management company. And then we let them know about the new laws that's coming down so that they can get a better understanding. So those board presidents, when they get ready to file their reports or take votes on upcoming increases, the community has a good understanding, or at least they have resources to reach out to if they have any questions. If they're concerned that the board might not be doing the proper thing, maybe they're overcharging, or maybe they're not charging at all and they should be charging. Maybe their board is not doing what they're supposed to do. And so it's really good if we can get more people involved. The more people we have involved, the more people we have that understand the process, it really helps keeps the checks and balances in place when you have board members either that are new or don't know what they're doing, and even you, even more experienced ones.
I work with a lot of associations throughout the state and a lot of different cities, a lot of different umbrella groups. And I will tell you, Lauderhill does it right. You really do. I have to tip my hat to you because, and they're always well attended. And that tells me something because I've done it year after year. And I see a lot of familiar faces, but the room's always packed. I know you have the police chief there. You have so many different city leaders there. And I think that's great. And honestly, that's what it's going to boil down to, because purchasing in one of these mandatory associations, it should be an informed purchase decision. People need to know what they're getting into. I mean, I remember being at an event years ago, not one of your events. It was an event that we at Becker had put on, and we had somebody in the audience stand up and say, "Well, you can't foreclose on my home. It's my homestead, my unit." Well, actually, that was misinformation that person did not understand, that living in a mandatory condominium association, yes, the association can foreclose on your unit if you don't pay your assessments. And it was kind of an eye-opening moment for me because I had no idea that somebody who's actually living in one of these communities could perhaps not realize that if you don't pay your assessments, you can lose your home.
That's right. Absolutely correct.
By the way, you mentioned my partner, Yolanda Cash Jackson. I'm sure she's doing a fantastic job for you. How do you get your share of the operating budget of Florida? How do you get in there and say, this is what we need? What's the process?
Well, that process, again, we provide as commissioners and myself, we'll provide the support. But the process is generally started or initiated through our city manager, who works through your partner, as you mentioned, Yolanda Cash Jackson. And we'll host our own meetings with our elected officials. And so we'll tackle it through our representatives that are up there, and as well as a two-pronged approach where our legislative liaison and our city manager is also using their avenue to try to get back what we need. And so our reps have been doing a good job of getting funding back. We recently got some funding for ShotSpotter for our crime prevention in the city. We recently got some funding from the state for our lift stations, our pump stations to get water and storm water out. So our reps been doing a really good job of getting us funding. And it also comes down to us being informed by you and your partner, having our liaison up there who has those relationships, which really makes it easy for us to get those appointments and get us some FaceTime so that we can share our story and share our concerns. And then they can hear directly from us.
So we've been talking about education, educating the people living in these communities. You know who else needs some education? Our legislators. So they need to know what it means to live in these communities and to operate these associations. By the way, I don't know if I told you this either. I used to be a lobbyist years ago. I would go up to Tallahassee, but only for community association issues. We have a group called CALL, which is the Community Association Leadership Lobby. And I would go up there and, you know, same thing, go into legislators' offices, talk about the bills. You know, they each get 6 bill slots. I can't tell you how often sometimes somebody was sponsoring a bill and didn't know what was in the bill, really, to any great degree. The session's starting earlier this next year. It's going to start in January. I think committee weeks are already going to start in September. Do you think, Ray, next time you're up there, that you're going to want to pop into some offices in addition to dealing with, you know, appropriations, talk about how some of these association laws are really impacting your communities?
Absolutely. And the ombudsman's office needs more help. We have way too many problems within the state. They just can't get to all of the problems. They can't check all the fraud. They can't keep up with it. So we have a lack of enforcement from the state, and the city doesn't have any enforcement teeth to really do anything. And we really can't go in and fire board members or remove them if we see bad things going on. So Yes, I plan to continue to fight for our regular appropriations as well as the impact on these communities that these new bills are having.
Let me know when you go. Maybe I'll tag along with you.
Absolutely.
So I wanted to ask you about this trend of preemption. Okay, so we're seeing the state in a lot of instances. We saw it again this session with vacation rentals. With occupational licenses, where we've got bills coming out and the state is basically saying, no, there's not going to be any local ordinances on this particular topic. Let's take Airbnb and short-term rentals as an example. State of Florida says, nope, local ordinances aren't going to be effective. It has to be the state regulating this activity. And, you know, there was a bill this year on occupational licenses, same thing. What do you, as a city official, think of this trend in Florida? And it's probably happening elsewhere as well, where the state wants to preempt any local ordinances or local control. Because I've always been of the belief that local government, you know, the people, you know your people better than they know in Tallahassee. We're a state filled with 67 counties. We're a very large state. I think we're the third largest state in the country. What do you make of this preemption trend?
Yeah, I'm totally against it. As you know, we preach the home rule. We never want to get away from home rule and allow us to do our jobs, because I think we can manage it what's best. And we also know what's impacting our residents the most, and what might work in one community may not work in another community. So we should not have these one size fits all rules. And so then if you want to ask me my philosophy, if we keep going this route, then what do they need local elected officials for? The state can just manage it themselves. There's no point in having local elected officials if we don't have the power to do what we need to do and what's best for our residents. I am a proponent of business. I do like the Airbnb model. I love the Uber model. I love where the future is going and the capabilities it's given us and access and making things more user-friendly. But there is a right place and a right time to do things. And sometimes some of these communities, I'll give you an example. When we create these rules, it may not necessarily get rid of the Airbnb model. It really just will push those business owners underground, and then we can't regulate them at all. And so take, for example, a 55 plus community who are used to maybe going to bed at 9 o'clock and, you know, just a real quiet community. And then you stick an Airbnb in there where you have party goers and they're going to have a big party this weekend. And grandma, who usually take their kids out by the pool, wasn't expecting 30, 40 people to show up for a pool party due to a one night Airbnb rental. So sometimes it's just not safe for some communities.
Yeah, it's not a great fit for everybody. Yeah, but what's driving this trend? Where do you know what's driving this trend in terms of the state trying to preempt local government?
I think, and I don't want to use the bad term lobbyists, I think there are some big companies out there who lobby our officials. And unfortunately, they're only getting one side of the story, going back to that education piece. They're not getting the impact of what's happening, or they're not hearing the story, and they don't live in communities that are affected by some of the laws that they're changing. So I think they're just not really given an opportunity to hear both sides, so that way we can make a bill that can kind of not just be extreme one way or extreme another, but that can help business owners and help the market, but also protect our residents and protect our communities. There is some sensible legislation that we can put together.
Yeah, I mean, the goal is to promote positive, helpful rather than harmful community association legislation. And I think it's hard to draft that in a vacuum. So if you're only hearing from certain lobbyists or you're only hearing from certain groups, you're really not getting the full picture. You know, when I did go up there and I would testify in front of a committee, I would start out by asking just a show of hands, how many of you live in a condominium association or homeowners association? Very few hands went up. In some committees, no hands went up. So they're not living in this type of housing option. If you don't live in an association, if you haven't served on the board of directors, you really don't understand the mechanics. Or I should say, you can't fully understand the mechanics. And you certainly can't understand the pressures of trying to govern the people you live next to, right? Because it is a living together relationship. And now you've got a finding committee, you're trying to enforce the rules. You're having to give bad news that the budget's going up more than 20%, you know, all of this. And if you haven't lived it, it's really hard to even imagine the true mechanics.
Right. And some people's experience of Airbnb, and I'll even say, use myself as an example. Every year, members of my family, we go up to Orlando and we Airbnb 10 bedroom houses up there, and the whole block is all Airbnb. So the communities that were designed to be Airbnb, or at least with that in mind, it's great. And so if you see that, and we love it, we're like, hey, we can go and stay in a 10 bedroom house with a pool, bowling alley, pool table, you know, all the amenities, movie theater. We think it's a great thing and it's a great concept. You come outside and the whole street is full of other vacationers and everybody's having a great time. So if that's the only view you have, you think Airbnb is great, but that's not always the case. There are some bad examples. And if that's your only exposure, then you're not really seeing the whole picture.
I agree. So I want to ask you, you founded a company called Extreme Government Solutions. That is a very interesting name to me. Tell me what the company does, how you came up with that name.
Yeah. So while I was in the military, I ran into many contractors. The military does a lot of subcontracting or contract some services. And when I kind of seen what they were doing and some of the services they provided, I wanted to get into that space. It was a little easier for me because I understood the terminology. I understood a lot of the military background and what they were looking for. So I started Extreme Government Solutions with that in mind. And then we morphed into focusing on veterans. And then I got a contract with the VA hospital where we take veterans out that were suffering from PTSD. So we put a program together where we were taking care of veterans suffering from PTSD. That contract came to a halt during COVID because they were the most vulnerable population. But prior to that and after that, there are many services and products that we provide to the military. There are companies out there that has products and services that the government needs, but they don't know how to market those products and services to the government, nor are they certified to do business with the government in the way the government does business. And many of them do not want to certify their companies in the way that the government needs you to do it. So I created a company and I provide that service. I get those products and services to the government. There are many things that don't fall in, you know, one category. And so that's where the solutions come in. So things like now, what we're talking about right now, condo management falls under ombudsman, not under the city. However, we got a gap in this process or this program. And so if the state wanted to hire an agency and say, hey, put together a program, tie these two things together and help us solve these problems, those are the type of things that I do. Or if there were any issues that the government just wasn't designed to do and they needed some out of the box thinking, that's what I enjoy doing.
Okay, I have a challenge for you. So we right now are having a lot of mental health challenges in our communities. And actually, as I sit here and I'm talking to you, I'm thinking about two communities I represent where they're actually veterans. And we believe the individuals probably have PTSD and there is a lot of acting out. There's a lot of angry, aggressive behavior at meetings. There's some threats being made. These are folks a little bit older. They're living alone. So there's no one there to really take care of them. No one really to make sure that they're taking whatever medicine they may be on. You know, we call it aging in place, right? People move into these communities. Think about somebody moved in their 30s, 40s, or 50s. Now they're 70s, 80s, or 90s, and they're in a condo unit. They have no family nearby. Even sometimes, Ray, when we reach out to an adult child, he or she doesn't want to get involved. It's a really heartbreaking situation when you're dealing with that. On the one hand, you've got people in the community who are afraid of this person because they are acting out, they are threatening people, and they may have firearms in their unit. And on the other hand, you have to have compassion for what that person's going through. And, you know, we tried to deal with the Baker Act. For instance, there was a bill that just passed this last session that has a requirement that the government now put out an updated booklet and guidelines on how to use the Baker Act. But Baker Act only, restrains someone for 72 hours for observation. Any thoughts? I for a long time have said this is a huge gap, which is mental health when you're in a multifamily building. Because listen, if you're in a homeowner association, you've got a little bit of space. There's a little bit of breathing space between you and your neighbors. But in a multifamily building, you're using the same elevator, you're walking the same corridors. And if there is somebody that is having an extreme mental health issue, it's going to likely impact his or her neighbors.
Right. You're absolutely right. And so those were the target audience was our veterans suffering from PTSD. You just kind of sum it up as the you said, aging in place, or you can call it the drunk old man in his apartment. What we did is we brought them together. We gave them we had a psychologist on board. What we would do is go through a series of activities, starting with the cohort is to build that trust. We want to get them to come out of their shell. Want them to trust people because a lot of times they retreat into their solitude because they don't trust society anymore. They don't trust their family anymore. They don't trust their neighbors. So we want to get them to start storytelling, get around campfires. Let's start sharing stories, develop trust and rapport. Then we take them on activities, small walks, hiking, biking, kayaking. We introduce new activities to them. Mindfulness training. We teach them yoga. And we just give them tools that they can do within their community when they get back home that don't cost a lot of money. It's free or very affordable. And just to get them trusting back in themselves to build their self-esteem again. So what I can maybe recommend for some of these communities, I see some communities have a great senior program where they meet at the clubhouse and they have a lot of activities. And those communities typically thrive better. But unfortunate, like you mentioned before, with all these increased fees, there are many clubhouses in these communities that are closed down. They don't have a working activity place. They don't have any place that everybody can come together and share a breakfast. So when I go out to those communities, I do try to do a breakfast and give them something to come out for But it comes down to funding. Who's going to pay for the program? The condo communities do not have the funding in their budget to pay for some of these resources. And it's not limited to just veterans. I got a nonprofit. I recently took out some firefighters that were exposed to gunfire. But our firefighter and our police officers are 911 operators. You don't have to go to war to experience trauma. And so it's becoming more and more prevalent. Even at the height of COVID, I heard more and more nurses were dealing with a lot of trauma and PTSD because people were dying on their watch daily. And so everybody needs some mental health. This is really becoming a big issue. It's something that we need to start looking at because it's only going to get worse.
So could if somebody's listening and they're experiencing this right now in their community, could they reach out to Extreme Government Solutions and have you come out? And
Absolutely. My nonprofit is EGS Outdoors, but absolutely, I'd love to consult and speak with anyone that has any concerns. I don't know if this is the time you want to get a telephone number.
Absolutely. Listen, I want people to have these resources because I think you might want to even expand on this. You know, I don't know, and I'm going to ask you in a minute what your future political plans are, but this is something that's so needed. And I don't see it. I don't see it diminishing. I only see it getting worse.
Right. We just need our legislators and our federal government to really put some funding behind it. Acknowledge that it's a problem, and then let's start working together as a community. There are a lot of resources out there that are already in place. I took my son. There's a horse healing. I forgot the name of the place, but when you're brushing the horse down, there's some therapeutic effects that go along with it. So we got a lot of great organizations that many people don't know about, but then also then the funding, you know, only so we can only be nonprofit and only serve so many people at a time.
So what's that phone number?
954-644-0578. And to prevent all the spammers, please send me a text first. you can send me an email at Sarai, that's Sarai.Ray.Martin@gmail.com.
You know, I had another idea while I'm sitting here talking to you is, again, back to the education part. We found when I did a lot of lobbying on behalf of community associations that phone banks set up to make it easy for people to reach out during the legislative session. And even when the legislators are outside of session, it's easy to go and set up an appointment, meet with them in their district offices. Might be something that you want to do in Lauderhill to allow your people, you know, make it easy for them to contact their legislators and the governor. And let them know whether it's an email form that you set up for them or, you know, a phone bank where they can just use an 800 number and call in.
Yeah, excellent idea. Thank you for sharing. And we'll look into that.
Well, you've been so generous with your time. I just want to know, am I going to see you in Tallahassee or Washington, D.C. in the future?
I don't know about all that. You know? right now, I am just looking for re-election. I think there's still some more work for me to do here in Lauderhill. I'm up for re-election for four more years in 2024. So I plan to just kind of stay right here where I am in the city of Lauderhill and continue the improvements that we can. And so right now, I can only look for the next 4 years.
All right. Fair enough. Well, you'd have my vote if I lived in your city. Thanks so much for your time today.
You have a good one. Bye-bye now.
Thank you for joining us today. Don't forget to follow and rate us on your favorite podcast platform or visit takeittotheboard.com for more ways to connect.